Today is Tuesday, November 17th, 2020. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Nancy Mulleady Meekum. And that's spelled N-A-N-C-Y-M-U-L-E-A-D-Y hyphen M-E-C-H-A-M. And my name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Nancy. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you.
Great. Nancy, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Nancy, what year were you born?
I was born in 1955.
Where?
I was born in Los Angeles, California, in Queen of Angels Hospital, where my mother worked as a nurse.
How did she meet your dad?
My mom met my dad through their parents. Parents played bridge together, other card games. And so when they were teenagers, they knew each other. And then they went on to date other people. Then after the war, they met again through their church. And the rest is sort of history.
What was your dad doing at the time?
My dad was a student. He was going to school for engineering. He went to UCLA and then moved up to San Francisco area and finished his degree at Cal Berkeley. My mom was a cadet nurse during World War II, and she had gotten her degree, and then she worked at St. Joseph's Hospital in San Francisco when my dad finished his degree in engineering.
Where did your mom, so cadet nursing, does that mean that she got her nursing studies through the services?
Yes.
Okay. And
it was a cadet nurse corps, which was started as a civilian nurse corps, but then they wore uniforms and helped. My mom was a scrub nurse and a what they call a circulating nurse in surgery. So she helped with a lot of the wounded people.
When did she go into the cadet corps for nursing?
43, 44, I think it was.
Okay. And did your dad serve in the service?
He did. He liked to say he was a grunt. He was in the 71st Division of the 3rd Army, and he was in Europe, and he fought in many battles, and he was on the Rhine when he got some shrapnel wound, but he didn't put in for Purple Heart because it was in his behind, and he was embarrassed by where it was.
Oh.
And he told the story about they were on an island in the Rhine, which I actually saw a couple years ago when I was on the Rhine.
Wow.
And he was a 60-millimeter mortarman.
Okay.
And so he had set up the mortar and the other mortarmen, so the Germans were shooting at them from the east, and then the Americans' mortars were falling short and hitting them on the island. And then people next to them, their mortars were under trees, so their mortars would go up and hit part of the tree, and then that would come down on them. So he wasn't sure who was shooting at him at the time.
How did they get on the island in the first place?
Oh, you know, they went over in little boats, I think it was.
Huh. Did he have hearing problems later on?
No, he didn't.
Oh, great.
Have hearing problems. He did well, and he went to, I'm trying to think of the German word for it, but he was part of the people that went up into the Eagle's Nest, Hitler's place.
Oh, wow. Up in Bavaria.
And, yeah, but my dad spoke German and spoke French.
Ah.
This Irishman, you know, he took it in school.
Okay.
And he wasn't a translator, but there was a point he told a story where they had a German officer. They had captured this hospital, which was being used by the Germans as a headquarters, and they needed some quick translation, and my father went over and was a major, and he was translating for his commander, and then when he was finished, they told him to take him back wherever he was going, and my dad did a detour, and my dad knew all officers had firearms that were not rifles, pistols, other things like that, so he asked the man in German where his firearm was, and he said it was in his office. So he said, Rauschmidt, and they went off to his office, and inside there were GIs already looting and looking for souvenirs. And my dad asked him in German where it was, and he said, it's behind the door. So my dad pulled the door open, and there was a beautiful Luger that he took with him, and all the GIs were disappointed, but my dad brought that Luger home
Oh my
from
gosh.
World War II, and would show it to us as kids. And then my brother has it now that my father's passed. But one of the things that bothered me the most about some of the more modern takes on World War II is my father saw people released from prison of war camp. And while he didn't go into a lot of details, it was an awful experience, and those people really were killed, and there was a Holocaust, and those deniers drive me crazy. Then he went, as part of the occupation force in Paris, and he went to school there, and he shared a flat with a bunch of other GIs, and it got so cold one winter that they cut down a telephone pole, and they fed it in through the window into the fireplace.
A little at a time.
Yeah, wow. A little at a time. So lots of stories my dad tells.
Oh, my gosh. And how old were your mom and dad, equal age? How old was your mom? How old
No,
were
my
dad?
Mom was a couple months older than my dad.
Okay.
Born in 24 and 25, 1924, 1925. My mom was born in 24.
Okay. And so she must have, you know, wanted to help the war effort. She got into the cadet nursing corps, mm-hmm. and it sounds like your dad, right out of high school, enlisted.
He was 17 going on 18, and he had poor vision. He had to wear glasses. With glasses, he had great vision, and he told us a story about how he went in, and he knew he wouldn't pass the eye exam. And so at that time, it was a very patriotic period of time, and so he went in without his glasses on, and the optometrist knew right away that he couldn't see the biggie on the chart. So he said, "Excuse me, I'll be right back." And in the meantime, my dad jumped up, memorized the eye chart. When the guy came back, asked him to name everything, and my father did.
Wow.
Without his glasses, because he memorized the eye chart.
That's great.
Yeah.
Huh. And so then, was he able to wear his glasses in service?
Yeah, they had military glasses, but and he could wear his own. For sure, but it was a matter of just getting past that first hurdle.
Right, huh.
Yeah.
Nice.
They called them the, we even have a book on the 71st how they went across Europe and where they ended up and all.
Okay. So your mom went through the training there. Did she get sent overseas, or did she stay
in
the States?
She took care of the people who came back.
Okay.
And then she worked in civilian care because there wasn't a VA at the time. So a lot of the soldiers were being taken care of in civilian hospitals.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes
so
sense.
She would tell me about different cases and different things wrong with people and what they did. And even as a kid, she would, even before penicillin, she would get boils on her forearms, and her dad would take an old whiskey bottle, like a fifth of whiskey, and boil water on the stove, and they'd pour it in this glass bottle. You know, the size of a fifth,
mm-hmm.
and then wearing asbestos gloves, they'd pour the water out and quick put the mouth of the bottle on the boil on the arm, which the temperature change and the pressure change would suck the pus out, and then the heat would cauterize the wound.
Wow.
And that's how they took care of several severe infections. She also told me during the war there was something called a Wagenstein, where they didn't have electricity at times.
How do you spell it?
Wagenstein. I think it's Wagenstein.
Okay.
I looked it up one time, and lo and behold, I was watching a MASH episode where they lost electricity, and Potter knew about a Wagenstein because it's a way of putting in a chest tube without electricity to suction the air out, and so you'd have bottles with different waters at different elevations above each other, and you can make this pressure that allowed a chest tube to work.
Oh, wow.
So my mom knew all these left-handed ways of doing things. And growing up as a kid, as anybody got hurt, nobody went to the doctors. They all came to my house, and my mom took care of them.
Neat.
Because as a nurse, we called them nurses, but they did so much more because of the lack of doctors. So she sutured. She did all kinds of stuff.
Was she interested in that as a child?
She loved to draw. She loved exploring. My mom had the most curious mind of all, and as a result, that's, I think, where I got mine. Because a lot of moms would send their kids out to play, and there were six of us. But she came out and played with us.
Oh, wow.
Time, when we were kids, we went to the local, well, semi-local appliance store, and she came back, not with appliances, but with boxes, six different boxes of refrigerator-sized boxes, and we'd put them in a line, and we'd paint them up, and one day we'd be a train, and the next day we'd be the African queen, and the next day we'd be something else. My mom helped us decorate our boxes, and we just had a blast.
Wow.
Just with these big old boxes. And one time a bird died, and so she sat down with me, and we, you know, dissected it together, and so she was great.
What year were they born, your mom and were they married,
my mom
your
was
mom
born,
and dad? Sorry.
My parents were married in 1948.
1948, okay.
June 26, 1948. My mom was born June 6, 1924. My dad, March 14th, 1925.
Okay. So you mentioned you were one of six?
Uh-huh. I'm 43F.
Wait, run that past me again.
I'm 43F. 43F. Fourth child, third female.
Thank you.
My dad, the engineer, when there were programmable phones, he would just put 43F and it would dial me or dial somebody else. You know, my sister Kathleen, she was 11. First child, first female, 11F. So he was fun that way. He also came up with fun. My dad was quick-witted, and he would come up with something, boat, and spell it B-O-T-E, Basic Overwater Transportation Equipment, boat.
Huh.
You know, so he was very clever.
Interesting. Wow. Okay. So your dad then went on for his engineering in Cal Berkeley.
Well, no, UCLA and Cal Berkeley about equal. And so when he finally got his diploma, he had to pick between them. And so he got his diploma that said UCLA, even though
he did.
Yeah,
okay.
It says UCLA, even though he went to both of them.
Hmm.
I think he went a little bit more to UCLA.
Was that because your mom was there?
No, my mom didn't go to UCLA. She went to nursing school, and I don't know.
I'm sorry. I would think that you know, your mom was working in L.A., and your dad, I guess had he finished his schooling by the time they got married in 48?
Oh, yes. He was already working as an engineer.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay. So when you were born then in 55, where you were born in L.A., so your folks were still living there?
Right. My dad worked for Space Technology Laboratory. He became an aeronautical engineer. He helped to design the lunar excursion module for the Apollo program
and
other things. But he worked for Space Technology Laboratories. He worked for North American Aviation, and then finally worked for and retired from TRW.
Okay.
And which was absorbed about 10 years ago by Northrop Grumman.
Okay. All out of the L.A. basin?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so that's where you grew up?
I did.
What was that
except
like?
For 2 years.
Okay.
I loved it. I'm a California girl. A Southern California girl. Big Dodger fan, big Vin Scully fan.
Okay.
But for 2 years, my dad was assigned to the Pentagon. And he learned to speak. My dad could speak five languages by the time he passed away. And he even could speak some Russian, but he worked for defense aeronautical aspects, which I really don't know a lot, other than I think it had to do with ICBMs and things like that and getting attacked. So he actually was part of the people that briefed the presidential staff for 2 years, and then he came back to California. But it was a 2-year appointment, so it was known that we were coming back.
Okay. So the 2-year appointment, was he offered basically then a job with an administration, or was that through his work?
Oh, no. He still worked for TRW.
Okay.
They had in addition to, you know, space contracts, they had defense contracts.
Okay.
So this was under the defense contract aspect of it.
Okay.
And he could not tell us. And I think that was kind of hard on my parents' marriage once he went from space technology stuff to defense stuff. He couldn't come home and, how was your day, dear? Fine. That would be it, you know.
Huh.
Couldn't really divulge anybody he talked to or what he said or what he did.
Wow. Yeah. And did your mom, I'm assuming that your mom left nursing to raise the children.
She did. Well, she did partially. She left paid nursing, and she raised the six kids, and she was there for us. But when we all became teenagers and fairly capable, we like to say we sent my mom off to camp, and she became a camp nurse.
Oh, wow.
Camp Waswagon in the San Bernardino Mountains. So every summer, she'd go off and be the camp nurse.
How do you spell Waswagon?
W-A-S-E-W-A-G-E-N.
W-A-S-E-W-A-G-E-N.
I think it was some sort of pseudo-Indian word,
yeah.
Camp Waswagon.
Okay.
But they, so when she was gone for however many months, my dad, being the engineer, would make a spreadsheet and put it on the refrigerator, and whose turn it was to make dinner, whose turn it was to do the laundry, whose turn it was to do this, and all that kind of stuff. So we all had our marching orders when Mom went off to camp.
Did he put his name on that list?
Of course not.
Okay.
My dad was very, I guess the word would be sexist.
Okay.
And I rebelled against this quite a bit. I was a tomboy, and my the girls did inside work, and the boys did outside work, and I didn't like that at all. And we had a lot of arguments because of that.
Okay.
And I, you know, when we lived at a place with a lawn, I wanted to mow the lawn, but I wasn't allowed to. I had to go in and do the dishes. We didn't have a dishwasher, so we would do them by hand.
Right.
And at one point, you know, being a product of the time that he was, he said if he had money to send somebody to college, it would be a boy because he has to support a family. It wouldn't be a girl, which is why I had to support myself through all of my college years.
Okay. And I think you mentioned there the crux of it, which was your dad was a product of his time.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
He was born in Illinois.
Okay.
My mom was born in Denver, Colorado.
Okay. And they were both in L.A., so you think they would have gotten some exposure to even Berkeley. Berkeley had a long history
in the 40s,
of being a...
I don't, it doesn't matter. He was conservative.
Okay.
And he was pretty much set in his ways.
Okay.
Well, yes, you would have thought, but it didn't happen. My mother, for instance, would say a black person had a great tan. And my dad was not as thoughtful in describing black people.
Okay. And yet they hung together and raised a family.
Yeah.
Because
that's what you did back then. You hung together.
Yeah.
Kind of a detente toward the end.
Oh, okay.
52 years they were married.
52 years. Okay.
I think they made each other laugh, and that's what worked out. You know, when the bloom comes off the rose, and then you have enough arguments about the kids, especially because I had a not very good brother, and that's what kind of pulled them apart was my brother's situation and antics. But they hung in there for everyone, and there was nothing they enjoyed better to have the family and the grandkids and the cousins and everybody over. I mean, we had so many people over family reunions because we ended up living near a beach, only 4 blocks from the beach as a teenager. And so everybody would come to the Melitti house, and we'd go down to the ball field, and there'd be enough for 2 full teams, and half the stands would be filled with Melitti and their clan. So
wow.
We had a lot of fun.
Did you learn to swim in the ocean?
I learned to swim in a pool in San Bernardino, and I remember the swimming lessons distinctly because I got so cocky one time as I jumped off the edge of the pool and did a pirouette on the way down, feet first, and hit my chin on the pool.
Ooh.
Split it open, and my mom, she wasn't even 5 feet tall. She reached down and pulled me out and then made a butterfly and fixed it up and let me go back in the pool because it had chlorine in it, so she could stop the bleeding. She was good with that.
Wow.
But my mom fixed stuff, and so I remember learning to swim as a little kid.
Okay.
And then when I went to the ocean, I'm a fish. I will swim anywhere at any time. It doesn't matter the temperature. I love it. And so I learned to body surf, and I specifically took a job between my junior and senior year of high school and my senior year, my first year of college, that I would get off at 3:30 so I could go back and run down to the beach, play volleyball, and go swimming till the sunset. I did that all summer long.
Nice.
And I worked on an assembly line where I made semiconductors and integrated circuits under a microscope with a whole line of 20 ladies. And if I wasn't going to go to college before that, I certainly was after that, because some of those people had been on that line doing the same thing for 20 years.
Wow. So
Yeah.
describe that to me. These were circuit boards you were soldering up?
There, it was called, the company was called TRW Semiconductors, and it was assembly line where things would go from person to person, and I would, under a microscope, take a solder, a gold solder, and connect one dot with another dot with a line of gold amalgam. And then it would go to the next one, and I would do that all day long.
So
Same thing all day
it
long.
would scoot into your station, you would solder these two dots, and then it would scoot off to the next station
Yeah.
all
That
day
would be
long.
it.
Wow.
All day long. Yeah, minimum wage. And my lady, the lead lady, her name was Barbara. She was this wonderful black lady. I think she was from Inglewood. And the thing I remember about her, other than she cracked us up and she took no prisoners, but I loved her dearly. She had this large bosom, and she told us one time she was like a 44, 44D or whatever it was. And sometime one of the ladies was asking her, because it was a real mix of people, black, white, Hispanic. I was actually in the minority in terms of white workers. And aren't you ever worried about going home? Because she lived in Los Angeles in Boyle Heights, I think it was, which we all know was not a very good part of town. Aren't you worried? And she reached in her cleavage. She pulled out a derringer. She goes, "Nope." And she put the derringer back on her cleavage. We thought
Wow.
Barbara was great.
Oh my gosh. So this would have been 72-ish,
Oh, I'm 17,
73-ish.
17 and 18. So, yeah, 72, 73, 73, 74, around there.
Yeah, 55, 65, 70. Yeah. Okay. For you were 15 in 1970, so it'd been 72, 73. All right. Yeah. Did you all go on summer vacation kind of things in the station
We
wagon?
did. We did. Well, we had a station wagon, a 54 Mercury that we called the 54 Merc, and my dad put seatbelts in. So we were probably one of the first car to have seatbelts, but he put them in, and we would go on vacations. We'd also, because there weren't a lot of freeways in Southern California, unbelievably, we would get up before the light would come up, and we would drive long distances on surface streets in Southern California to get to families, homes who might be in, let me see, where would they have been? Tustin, trying to think, Riverside, where else? This would have been from San Bernardino, Norwalk area.
So it would take you
And
most of the day just to get across the LA basin.
it would take several hours.
Okay.
And you wanted to get there by 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning, so we'd get up at, like, I think 5 o'clock or something. I know it was still dark. And if you had to go to the bathroom with 6 kids, you couldn't keep stopping. So my mom had Tupperware. One of her sisters worked for Tupperware. So she had a big Tupperware bowl, and it had a top with a hole in it. And so boys could pee in the bottle, and girls would sit on the Tupperware top, and we would pee as we went along.
Wow.
There were, we didn't stop much. And then, because we were still sleepy, the seats were put down in the station wagon, and we wouldn't wear our seatbelts at this time. We'd all just be asleep in the back of the station wagon as they drove off to wherever we're going.
Where did you go?
Whittier, I think, is where we went the most because my dad had a brother there, and my mom had a sister there.
Okay. And so these were trips to visit with family.
Right. And then when we went on vacations,
Yeah.
I remember we used to go up to Lytle Canyon when I was a real little kid, because
How
we
do you
have
spell
three seats.
that?
LYTLE.
Okay.
Lytle Canyon is on the way up to San Bernardino Forest, Angeles National Forest.
Okay.
But mostly we went to the east side and the west side of the Sierra Nevada, to the national parks or to wilderness areas. My love of the east side came from these vacations. We would stop at a place called Dirty Socks, which is not there, or Dirty Socks is still there. It was called that because there's sofas south of Keeler on Walker Lake, no, Owens Lake. And we'd stop at a place called Little Lakes. And there was always this store there, and we would go inside and use the bathroom and maybe have a soda or something. But here we all got to buy a little tapestry. mine was like 3x2 of polar bears.
Hmm.
And I still have that on my wall. I just love that.
Huh.
But after I grew up, I heard that, and I've seen since then that this building has burned down, and so Little Lake Store is not there anymore, but we would stop there, and we would go up the east side, and we would just camp everywhere. We often went up to Kennedy Meadows. Now, there's two Kennedy Meadows in the Sierra Nevada. One is off Highway 108, which is near Sonora, way up here where I am now. The other one is off Southern California, south of Lone Pine, and that's we went there a lot, and we used to camp. And my dad had this great big tent. We all set up the tent, and there was a left side, a right side, and the middle, and the boys would be on the left, and the girls would be on the right. My parents would be in the middle.
Hmm.
Went on wonderful hikes and stuff. We often went up to Sequoia National Park, and we went to Devil's Post Pile, and we went down in Southern California to Mount Palomar State Park. Lots of places. And one time, my dad had tickets to go to a Dodger game, and he took the top three. Remember, I'm number four. And so he took Kathleen, Tom, and Sheila, and I, the baseball fan of the family, didn't get to go. He was being egalitarian, not taking the fans. Sheila could care less, and Kathleen could care less, but they went. And so I was so distraught that I couldn't go to this Dodger game that my mom must have communicated this with a friend of hers. We went over to her house, and she had this old raggedy saddle, and it didn't even have stirrups on it, and she gave it to me. And I would sit on that saddle on a barrel or on this, that, the other thing, and just ride off in the sunset. I just loved it. And I'm one of those 7-year-olds that fell in love with horses and never fell out of love with horses. So I worked at stables when I was 12. I did horse patrol at the Grand Canyon. Today, every year I lead backcountry horse packing trips in the Sierra Nevada. So horses have always been a big part of my growing up, but I'll never forget my first saddle.
Nice.
Oh,
that's
fun.
And you were 7, roughly?
Would I have been there? No, I was a little bit older. I think I was 9.
Okay.
7 when I fell in love with horses. Ah. My first saddle, I think, was 9.
Okay. Did you ever own a horse?
Yes and no. Yes, I had a horse, but I didn't own it just by me.
Okay.
When I worked at some stables, there was a horse named Dynamite. It was a Western cut horse, and I could seat well. That means I didn't get thrown off very easily.
Hmm.
I learned to ride when I was 3 years old. There's even a picture of me on a horse.
Wow.
At my uncle's ranch in Solvang, California. And I remember visiting, and this time I was probably 4-5 years old. And I was riding behind my cousin, there are tie downs on the back of saddles for tying your jackets.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the back of the saddle sitting on the horse, and we were just running across this big open area, and the tie downs broke. And I fell off the horse and fell on my butt, and they just kept going. He had no idea I'd fallen off, but I knew he'd come back. So I just sat there holding the tie down until he came back. And I think that's 5 years old. No, I've been riding ever since I was 3.
And where was this ranch? I'm sorry, I missed
it. Solvang?
How do you spell that?
Solvang. It's inland from Santa Barbara.
Okay.
And then, again, about 5 or 6, no, probably 6 or 7, again, we were at the ranch, and Sam the Palomino was getting old, and so my Uncle Bob cautioned us, now, don't ride double on Sam. Sam's getting old. So my brother Tom says, we won't ride double, we'll ride triple. So he put 3 of us on, and of course we were bucked off immediately. But that was the beginning of not trusting my brother Tom, too.
Okay. Interesting. So, loved horses.
I didn't expect these stories.
This is great.
For you to make all these stories come out, this is interesting.
There you go. What do you remember about your first Dodgers game that you actually were able to go to?
Oh, my goodness. Well, Vin Scully, everybody took a transistor radio. And you listened to Vin Scully on the radio while you watched the game.
Really?
And he would say things like, it's the third base umpire's birthday today. So in the 6th inning, I'm going to get you all started. So at the 6th inning, in between things, we'd all sing, happy birthday to you. And the umpire would look up and go, what the heck is going on?
Because he wouldn't be listening to the radio.
No, but all 50,000 people in the stadium.
Oh, my gosh.
But then when I became a teenager, Well, I should precede this with, I'll post it with another story. If you got good grades in school, you got free Dodger tickets. And I thought, well, if that's all it takes, then I got A's, and I was published in the Los Angeles Times as an A student, and I would get free tickets, and your name would be published in the paper, and I would go to Dodger games that way. Of course, it took somebody to take me there, so my parents or aunt or uncle or somebody would get us to the game.
Okay.
But when I was a young kid, I guess I was having problems in school. I was in Catholic school for the first 3 years, and the second grade teacher, Sister Mary Helena, my memories of her are so positive and wonderful, but she said, I guess she pulled my parents in and said, she's not stupid. There's something wrong, but she's not getting any of this. And she said she needs to go to an optometrist. So she says, I moved her to the front of the class, and it got a little better, but not bad. But I remember being 7 years old, and there was some sort of a band parade outside when I got my first pair of glasses at the optometrist. And I remember putting them on and looking out the window and seeing the light off of the brass instruments, and that I could see them for the first time and how sharp everything was. And it was just amazing. I remember being able to see for the first time at 7.
Wow.
Before that. And to this day, because I learned to see without glasses for so long, that when I swim in the ocean without glasses, I can read the waves that are coming by the shadows and the lights and the things. I know how far away they are, and I know how to catch them. I don't think I could have done that had I not learned to see through lights and shadows. And I really think that's, you know that I like to draw.
Hmm.
And,
I didn't.
I send you a Christmas card every year with my drawings on it.
Yeah, but do I realize you're drawing those?
Anyway,
well, okay.
So those are my drawings. And so I draw not so much looking at what it is, but what I see. And what I see is light and dark.
Hmm.
So anyway.
Okay. And so after you got the glasses, did that... Did things?
Oh, I straight A's after that.
Okay, all right. Yeah. I'll go back to the Dodgers tickets based on good grades. Was that something that the school did, or the Dodgers did?
It was sponsored by the Los Angeles Times.
Okay.
And it's for everybody in LA County. At this time, I was living, I can't remember if it was when I came back, when we came back from Maryland, and I was 12 years old, so it was in junior high, and then in high school.
Okay. So that would have been a nice perk then.
It would have been, but I have and that's all it was to me was a perk. I'm the kind of person that if I was given an assignment due in a month, I'd go home and start it that day.
Hmm.
I am not a procrastinator. I hate things hanging over my head. I like to get things done so that I can move on to the next thing that needs to be done.
Yeah.
So I'm a doer. That's how I define myself. I'm a doer.
So baseball and horses, swimming,
baseball,
or fish.
Mm-hmm.
What else? What else did you really enjoy as a child growing up?
Running, just running anywhere, running and throwing things. I always got in trouble for throwing things, but if somebody said hand me that, I'd always toss it to them. I ran everywhere. I was a regular little Forrest Gump girl.
Okay.
Laughing. I liked laughing.
Cool.
Exploring. Oh, my God. I loved exploring.
Like what? Where?
Oh, my goodness. When we lived in San Bernardino, I was a little kid, and we had a fairly large area. We had a front yard, a backyard, a side yard, and I would go crawl through the bushes, and I'd climb up the trees, and I would find an old building, and I'd explore it for bats, just going anywhere that I could go, anything new.
Nice. Were your brothers and sisters like you? I mean, I'm thinking back on your mom and dad. Very intelligent people, very smart, creative. People of their times, I get that. But I always think of, when I interview people, I think about their parents and how much their parents made the people I'm talking with.
Mm-hmm.
Did your parents encourage and foster your knowledge for exploration and
My mother did.
Okay.
My mother did. my father, again, he was caught in a time warp.
Yeah.
So when I was a, to give you an example, when I was a high school student, my freshman year I took biology when you're supposed to take it as a sophomore. The next year I took chemistry. The next year I took physics. They ran out of science classes for me, so they invented for me by my senior year. I had a wonderful mentor, Elizabeth Estel, and we were doing all kinds of things, and she taught me how to do experiments and how to write things up. So I did one, and a very elaborate experiment, and submitted it to a national science foundation called the Westinghouse Science Talent Search. Now it's called Intel Science Talent Search, I think.
Okay.
But anyway, I won. And
wow.
Application and effects of low temperature and amoeba proteus in relation to pinocytosis.
Wait,
anyway.
Spell those out for me.
I'll just say the word slowly. Application and effects of temperature on amoeba proteus in relation to pinocytosis.
Which means?
Which means that I did an experiment with a little amoeba that you look at under the microscope, the little single-celled organism.
Right.
And when you eat something as a single cell, the eating is called phagocytosis. When you take in liquids, it's called pinocytosis. And how was that affected by temperature? And I used toluene blue, and I used different temperatures and thermometers, and you know, how to write the question, how to write it up. I mean, I was winning. I won several awards as a senior. And I, as a result of winning this science talent search, I got offered free rides to about maybe 20 different colleges throughout the United States, and letters from the senators. I'm trying to remember the name of this senator, one senator, you know, from California. His father was a no, I forget what his name is. Anyway, I got letters from senators, congratulations, all that stuff. But I only wanted to go to UCLA. I wanted to go to UCLA for specific reasons, but they didn't offer me a ride. I only got partial scholarships for 1 year to UCLA. And my father said, you should go to one of these other places. They'll pay for the whole thing. And I said, but I don't want to go to those places. I'm going to go here. And because of that, he did not help me in school at all, ever.
Why did you only want to go to UCLA? I mean, not in defense of your father here, but I'm saying, gee, you know, a 4-year free ride today, that happens, can happen quite a bit. But back then,
it was because of what they offered, what they were doing, what I wanted to do, and the programs they had there, and where I wanted to be. I didn't want to go to Pennsylvania. I didn't want to go to Wyoming. I wanted to stay in California.
Uh-huh.
And this school had two things. I also was a college athlete. I was on the basketball and the softball team at UCLA. In fact, when we were practicing my freshman year of basketball, the men's coach came over and talked to us and said, way to go, and that was Coach Wooden. So, I mean, it was,
oh, wow.
It was really fun to be a part of that.
This is Coach Wooden from Indiana John Wooden. Wow.
Yeah. So there was, because I had affiliations with UCLA already, because as a high school student, I was already going there to the library doing studies because I thought perhaps I wanted to go and be a surgeon, and I thought I wanted to go and be a biologist, and then I decided I wanted to be an East African ecologist, and I had a chance to listen to Jane Goodall lecture in Southern California, and that really inspired me, and I knew, anyway, for a host of reasons, I wanted to go to UCLA.
Okay.
And so I did.
Let's go back to high school for a minute, because I do want to kind of cover that a little bit. What sports were you interested in high school? I mean, clearly.
I was in MiraCosta High School, and I was in the Girls Athletic Association, GAA, all 4 years lettering. And the first year I was on track, but they, I ran, and I short distances, and did field work, you know, stuff. We didn't have javelin, but we had shot put. We had jumping and things like that. And then the next year they had to cut some winnings, so they cut the women's track and field.
Oh, wow.
So after that, I played basketball and softball every single year. And one of the senior awards I got was in athletics, as well as in laboratory science and field science.
Nice. Mm-hmm. And where did you go to high school?
MiraCosta High School in Manhattan Beach.
Okay.
And another mentor that meant a lot to me, and I'm still in touch with him today, is Gary Hartzell. He was a history teacher, and he and Jean Hartzell, his wife, became very good friends, and I babysat their boys, who are now in their 40s, and I'm still in touch with them. So,
how do you spell Gary's last name?
H-A-R-T-Z-E-L-L.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. He was on Laura Bush's library committee.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he went back to school and got his PhD in library sciences.
So thinking about...
I loved high school.
Okay.
I loved my junior year of high school most of all, because then I could drive. My dad loved it when we could drive, because then they didn't have to drive us anywhere. We could drive each other everywhere.
Well, how many? I mean, did he get another car?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, we got a 1960 Studebaker we named Charlie.
A 1950 or 1960?
60. 1960 Studebaker.
Okay.
And we named it Charlie. And we also had a 1965 Chevrolet van that my dad had bought new in Maryland. And we brought it back. And so the van held 8 easily. So I remember in the summertime when we were all teenagers and had jobs, we would all get in and somebody would drive and drop each one of us off at a job and then come pick us up at the end of the day. So like I had a sister who worked at Unimart, which became Target. I worked at Taco Bell. Somebody else worked at Pier 1 Import. So it was really interesting times.
Yeah. Gosh. So it sounds like you had some amazing teachers in high school that matched your keen interest in studies and desire to learn. That's really wonderful.
Yes. Oh, it was. I love learning. I love going to school, which is probably why I've just kept going.
Okay. Okay. I was thinking of Elizabeth S. Toll
and Gary Hartzell.
And Gary Hartzell. You know, a couple of people that taught you from high school that you remember now.
Mm-hmm. And Sylvia Hawley, she's passed away. She was one of two black teachers at the school. And she was the coach of the basketball team and the assistant coach of the softball team. And she was a PE teacher.
Okay.
But I'll never forget, I just thought the world of her. And we were doing rehearsals for graduation. And I was CIF. I was first in line of the ones that wore the CIF things. And we were practicing walking out of the stands. And I'll never forget her sitting there going, "Way to go, Melidi." And to have my coach say I did good because of academics was huge to me. I could still see that. And it meant it's okay to be smart and a jock, too, you know?
Yeah. How do you spell Sylvia's last name?
H-O-L-L-Y.
Thank you. Wow. Again, another strong teacher supporting students.
Yes. Hmm. Yes. Huge.
Okay, so you were looking to go to UCLA for the sports that it offered and for curriculum that it offered.
Primarily for the science.
Okay.
And then I just liked to play. I had to quit all of my sports my sophomore year. Because of two reasons. One,
in UCLA or
at UCLA.
Okay.
At UCLA, I had a scholarship. I had multiple scholarships the first year, but they all ran out after the second year.
Oh.
And if I was going to stay in sciences, all of them had labs or field trips, and I either had to pick between the sciences or traveling off to the University of Pennsylvania to play softball. You know, making things up. So being an athlete, a UCLA student athlete, did not go well if you were a science major, a serious science major. So I stopped my sports after my freshman year because
okay.
I had to go to work, had 3 or 4 different jobs beginning my sophomore year.
What did you do?
Well, one of the jobs was very interesting. I read to blind students. This is before audiobooks.
Oh, wow.
And so I would read to them. And I remember going to the Braille reading room, and they had all kinds of magazines and stuff, one of which was Playboy. And, yes, they did read it for the articles because there were no pictures for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I re- remembered I hated psychology for whatever reason. I know it's because of my brother, but I hated psychology. And one of the students was a psychology major, so I had to read him an entire textbook in psychology.
Oh,
so
wow.
That was. But as I read it, they recorded on a cassette what I was saying so they could listen to it again. And so just like you, they would ask me to spell a word or whatever. So I read the blind students. I was a intramural field referee out of the – I got that job easily because, you know, they said, we want you to be a student athlete. And I said, I can't, but, you know, can you pay me to be a – you know, when the students go together and they play flag football and stuff, I could be one of the referees and get paid that way. The biggest job I had beginning my sophomore year was I worked in a microbiology and immunology laboratory. And that was very fulfilling, very insightful, and very difficult. I'd get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go to the lab, and I would harvest liquid cancer called ascites, A-S-C-I-T-E-S, from mice, and then prepare it for being reinjected into other mice I worked for Dr. Benjamin Bonavida, B-O-N-A-V-I-D-A, his laboratory, and what they were doing is they were doing something new, which is used quite commonly now, called monoclonal antibodies, and there was something called a gamma counter. And to give you an idea, is you take these tumor cells, and cancer reproduces much faster than other cells.
Mm-hmm.
You put in radioactive iodine, and they're growing in this medium, and you treat it with whatever it is you're going to treat it. And if it works on the cancer cells, they explode and release this radioactive iodine, which you can then count in the gamma counter.
Hmm.
And so if you put these things in the gamma counter and you get a low count, that means whatever it is you were trying to kill the cancer with didn't work. But if you got a high count, there's something here that maybe is killing these cancer cells.
God.
My job as a technician was not to do the experiment, but to maintain the cancer cells so they could do the experiment. So I was taught very well how to do things, and I remember there was the senior lab technician in there. I wish I could remember her last name, but her name was Barbara. She was Asian-American, and she wouldn't swear, but she used to say shoots, S-H-O-O-T-S. So every now and then I say shoots instead of somebody saying a bad word.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would go in, I'd grab the mouse, put forceps behind its neck, pull its tail, break its neck, go into its, slice it open, harvest the cancer, put it in these things, go in and spin it down with media, and then they would work on them during the day. I would then come back in the middle of the day, make media, which is the growth factor that these cells grow in, or assist in doing that. Then I'd come back at 9 o'clock at nighttime and make sure everything went into the incubator correctly and everything was maintained well. And then re-inject other mice with this new strain to keep the strain going. So it was a minimum wage job, but I also did things like went to the copy machine, and if you wanted a copy of a journal article, you could ask for it, and you might get it in 3 weeks if they mail it to you, or you just copy it out of the journal and send it to somebody else in the department. So I worked the copy machine a lot, but. As a result of that, my last couple years of college, I was a B rather than an A student, which really frustrated me, but I had to work.
Yeah.
And then after that, for my master's degree and for my PhD work, I was straight A's because I had work that I could do that, like teach, which was fun and easier for me than getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning or
Right. Getting
blind students or whatever.
So these things, reading to the blind students and coaching the intramural, coaching the sports and working in the lab.
That was 3 of 4 jobs, yeah.
Was all that through UCLA, and they would say, okay, you do this for us and we'll reduce your tuition?
Oh, no. They were just paid jobs.
Okay.
Paid jobs.
All right.
And then the last job I had is I had to move out of the dorm because I couldn't afford the dorm. I lived in Sproul, S-P-R-O-U-L, Hall. Second floor, and then my sophomore year, I moved to an off-campus facility, and I was one of the RA's resident assistants, so I had to be there at certain times, make sure people followed the rules, make sure the doors were locked at nighttime,
okay.
That kind of stuff. So I have four jobs, my second, third, and fourth year of college.
Did you ever talk to your mom about this and say, hey, you know, I'm doing well, I'm enjoying this?
My mom would slip me what she could, 20 bucks here, 20 bucks there.
Wow.
Finally, my sister Sheila, who was, we're Irish twins, we're only 11 months, 2 weeks, and one day apart.
Mm.
So we're very, very close. And she actually had a job on campus, and we would have lunch together. She goes, you look awful, you need to go to student health. And I said, I don't want to go to student health. So finally I went to student health, and they said I was anemic because I wasn't eating right,
mm-hmm.
which was true. And so Sheila would buy me blocks of cheese and things like that. So I used to have, after I left my freshman year when you worked in the dorm, then I had a little toaster oven, and I had a pot with a handle, and I would put Campbell's chicken noodle soup in the pot and stick it into the toaster handle with the handle sticking out, and that's how I would heat my soup because you're not allowed to have hot plates.
Right.
And I'm a rule follower, but there was nothing about toaster ovens.
Okay.
So I would have my Campbell's chicken noodle soup, and I lost a lot of weight in college, and I probably didn't eat right, but my sister would give me blocks of cheese, and my mom would slip me money here and there. My father and I became estranged.
Mm. Okay. Yep. And these things happen.
Yeah, we got sort of back together later on when I became a park ranger for the National Park Service, and he came and visit. They would come and visit me and see me in my uniform and see me giving walks, talks, even programs, being capable, and later on doing search and rescue and all that stuff. My mother said he was very proud of me and all that kind of stuff, but he just couldn't see it back then. He was still very biased, guys over gals, you know.
Right. Well, it's difficult for his generation. Women were teachers or nurses or moms.
No, they stayed at home. They stayed at home, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He was that extreme.
And so he would be like, well, why do I want to invest in that?
Right.
You know.
And all you do is you're going to get married and have kids, and what are you going to do with that education?
Right.
Because my older sister, Kathleen, well.
I mean, it's such a defeatist argument, but.
It is, but I was a straight-A student. I was the one who was reaching for the stars, and, you know, it was just my older brother was a mess, and then my older sisters each had issues, and I was truly the one that achieved in the family and the one who wanted to get out there and be a part of life, so it was frustrating. So I just made, and ever since then, I've been making my way into life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So camping, growing up, kind of in high school, but working summers, sports, and you mentioned you had attended a talk from Jane Goodall.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and yes, I wanted to be an East African ecologist in the worst way.
Did those, it sounds like you wanted to be a Renaissance woman, sort of exposed and knowledgeable in many things.
It is. I couldn't decide, you know, really. I wanted to be everything and do everything. There was a show when I was a kid called Doctari, and it was about a guy who was a doctor in East Africa. He was a veterinarian doctor, and he was a people doctor. And I said, oh, God, that's what I want to be.
Hmm.
I want to do it in East Africa, and I want to drive a Land Rover, Defender,
uh-huh.
you know, and all that stuff. And I wanted to do that. And so that was my goal in life, was to do that. And
how did you manage that in UCLA? Because universities want, at the end, a certificate that has one thing on it.
That was interesting, because when I went to UCLA and decided I was going to be an East African ecologist, people asked, they would ask my major, and I'd say biology, and they said, are you pre-med? And I said, no. Are you pre-dent, dental? No. Are you pre-vet? No. Just a biologist. I was one of the handful of biology students that was going in to be a biologist there, but it was rigorous, because for your biology major, it took 3 physics, 3 calculus, and 6 chemistry classes let alone the biology, just to do that. And I would have the very best background because of that.
I bet.
So I knew I could get into any graduate school with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even UCLA. I mean, because my senior year, because I did so well, I did field studies and in the desert, and I did field studies at Catalina Island. And later on, I got a job that summer working, or 2 summers later, working as a marine biologist at the Institute for Marine and Coastal Studies at Catalina Island. And my very first published paper was done based upon a sea cucumber, which is a holothurian, an echinoderm, that I studied with the director there. And so my first published paper was as a marine biologist.
Cool. So let's go back to the desert for a minute. What studies were you doing, field studies in the desert?
I did studies on two different things. I studied Dipodomys, which is a kangaroo rat, the genus for kangaroo rats. And so I would get up early in the morning, and I'd walk the mile and a half to my study site where I'd set out my traps, and I would identify who it was, key them out, mark them, release them, and then come back, have breakfast, then go back out and study antelope ground squirrels, and then come back. But because this was a group thing, we would all sit down and we'd listen to everybody else. Somebody was studying Scaloperus, you know, which was a western, what's the common name of it, yellow-bellied lizard, and somebody else was studying this, and somebody else was studying that. So we would learn about how they were doing their studies and how we would do all that. And I remember the professor, he brought one of his telescopes, and it was the first time I really remember seeing Saturn in the rings of Saturn.
Oh, wow.
Telescope.
How do you spell Scaloperus, by the way?
Oh, Scaloperus occidentalis, O-S-C-E-L-O-P-O-R-O-U-S. That's just the genus.
Yeah.
For the western fence lizard or blue-bellied.
Okay.
So I learned a lot there. And then, you know, the marine biology work, that was half the semester. And then I graduated. And that summer I had a job with a pretty famous physicist. His name was Cole, C-O-L-E, and he worked at UCLA. And he was doing something called helical electrophoresis. H-E-L-I-C-A-L-E-L-E-C-T-R-O-P-H-E-S-I-S. Electrophoresis was in its early stages, and it's a way of using molecules within DNA to separate them out to make a blueprint of them.
Hmm.
You could see what they were, and that's what electrophoresis does. And that's the basis for identifying somebody's DNA today. And he had a way of doing it in a system that went from floor to ceiling that was a helix, like a great big spiral. And my job was just to make the media.
Okay.
In the laboratory. But I would go in and talk to him, and he had a signed picture from Einstein on the wall.
Oh, wow.
He was really a cutting-edge chemical physicist at the time. And he was the basis for, you know, DNA fingerprinting today. So I had a chance to work for him for a summer.
Oh, wow. Very cool. Let's go back to Catalina Island for a minute. And talk about this, your first published paper. So Catalina Island is, 50 miles off the coast, or how far?
No, it's like that old song, 26 miles across the sea.
Okay.
Santa Catalina. So it's 26 miles. And if you look at it in profile, there's kind of a mountain range and then a dip. And then another mountain range, and that dip is called the isthmus, where you can walk from one side of the island to the other without having to go over any mountains.
Okay.
And that's where the USC-UCLA Institute for Marine and Coastal Studies. So when I was there as a student, it was learning how to do science and marine biology, and it was the coolest thing because I'm still friends with two of the grad students that were there at the time, Rich Nelson. Babette Nelson and Rich Ambrose, who later got married. And I would go back and stay with them multiple times. But you were studying something in particular, and I was studying a sea star, some people call it a starfish, called Lynkia leviuscula, L-I-N-C-K-I-A, L-E-V-I-S-C-U-L-A. And most people know that when a sea star loses an arm, it grows another arm. Well, the sea star I was studying, yes, it would grow another arm, but the arm would grow a whole other sea star.
Wow.
And so somehow it was able to turn the locks off its DNA to not to grow a whole other organism. It's called asexual reproduction. So my research was why? What makes it do that and nobody else? And so I was looking at things, okay, why would you not reproduce successfully sexually to keep your species going? Why would you have to make more of you in another way? So I was looking at predation pressures, male to female ratios, all kinds of different things with my study. But the cool thing about being a senior capstone student there was you dove twice a day for your work. But then everybody else has a study too. So there's like 14 of us. So you ended up diving 7 or 8 times a day, scuba diving.
Wow.
I learned to scuba dive when I was 15. Scuba dive, because my next door, one of my jobs was making wetsuits. Oh, I should digress for a second.
Yes, please.
My next door neighbor was one of a twin, Bill and Bob Maestral, and they had a dive shop called Dive and Surf.
How do you spell their last name?
M-E-I-S-T-R-E-L-L. They later invented a company called Body Glove.
Oh, no kidding.
Things like that, yeah. And so so I learned to scuba when I was 15, got my certification at 16. And so this year is 50 years I've been scuba diving.
Wow.
And they were just wonderful. So I had all my stuff, and I went in, and he goes, after I graduated from the class, and I was all ready to go and enjoy the sport of scuba diving at a 16-year-old, which means diving off the beach a lot because you don't have a driver's license yet.
Hmm.
And so I went into Dive and Surf, and he fitted me out in a wetsuit with a hood and got me the tank and the BC, the buoyancy compensator, and a regulator and a mask and snorkel and all that stuff. And he said, okay, got $100? And I said, I do, because he had talked to my parents what I had saved up. I do, here it is. And I paid, you know, ones and 20s and five. Goes, that's exactly what this is. This is over $600 worth of stuff, I later found out.
Wow.
But he was just a wonderful person. So I went to when I was at the Institute doing biology, he would come by all the time in their boat, and they would pick me up, and we'd go diving, and he'd do all kinds of stuff. But anyway, I learned to dive as a kid, and I had thousands of dives, because I'd just go off the cliff at Palos Verdes or go off the beach with friends and just get my tank filled and take off again.
So diving 7 to 8 times a day, how did you get any studying done? That sounds great to me. You get to see what other people are doing and
you sleep 4 to 5 hours a night.
Okay.
The whole thing but they're only, 45-minute to an hour dives each and in between. But this is how we learn, because, for instance, when I dove with Rich Ambrose, he was studying octopus.
Hmm.
So we would go down, and he'd have these slurpee guns, and we would go to where the octopus eggs were at the back of a lair, and when they would come out, they'd be these tiny little white things with these little short arms,
Hmm.
You'd slurp them up. And then when I helped Bobette with her stuff, and I went back and helped them several times beyond just class, she was studying a worm called Serpulorbis, S-E-R-P-U-L-O-R-B-I-S, and it lived in a calcium tube. And over time, it changed its sex or gender. And so she was studying this. Why did it do that? How often did it do that? And so she had this big plastic sheet that she would put on put over the colony. The colony is, say, as big as your floor in your house where the coffee table is.
Wow.
And so we put that out, and she'd go around with a grease marker, and she'd mark this, that. And my job was to hold it down, and be a safety diver too.
Hmm.
And then she would do her thing, and then she'd turn to me, and she'd put her finger in the air, and she'd circle it around, which means I got to go swim back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, because it's cold in that water. This is not tropics. It's cold. And so I would get cold and start to shake a little bit. So
mm-hmm.
Then I'd just go back and back. Then I'd come back and hold her thing down a little bit. I helped another person study rockfish. I helped another person study sea cucumbers. Helped, so you learned all about everything and everybody else's. So you get together and you play ping pong, you play pool, you talk about different things, you bounce things off of each other. But this was not so much studying, because we'd done it. We had rickets, we had these, which is the name of the text, between Pacific tides. We had other textbooks, but we were doing research. We were making notes. We were writing things down at this point. We were not, quote, studying so much.
Right.
because we were out in the field doing things.
Okay.
And then we would sleep, and then I'd get up, hike up to Estrella Endosa Hill, which was the hill above the Star Hill, the above the dorm there, and then I'd come back down, and then we'd go down to the dock, and off we'd go to do more stuff.
Hmm. Okay.
And I did very well in my studies to the point where the director, Bob Givens, G-I-V-E-N-S, asked me if I wanted to come back and help with this sea cucumber study that he didn't have time, but if I wanted to do the work, I could co-author the paper.
Wow.
So I did, and so the sea cucumber was off of a little rock off the isthmus called Ship Rock at 125 feet, which is, you normally do, you know, at 33 feet, that's one atmosphere. Every 33 feet you go down, you have to spend less time around at that depth,
mm-hmm.
or bubbles, nitrogen bubbles will go into your bloodstream, and if you came up too soon and didn't give it time to go out of your bloodstream, then you get the bends and you could die. We had a bariatric chamber there, a decompression chamber there for people who had emergencies. And so what you needed to do is, if you're going to spend more than 7 minutes at 125 feet, you had to stop at different depths coming up and just breathe and breathe and breathe. So we had tanks tied to the rope at different elevations. So we could work, say we worked down there for 35 minutes studying our Holothurian, our sea cucumber. And then we'd go up and we'd stop at, you know, 118 feet and we'd breathe a certain amount. Then we'd go up to 100 feet and breathe a certain amount. And we'd work our way up. It often took us several hours just to come up to the surface after spending only a half hour at the bottom.
Wow.
So we won't get decompression sickness. But anyway, it was a whole new sea cucumber. I got to describe it for the first time and extend its range. And so Holothuria zacophyiforma is my first publication.
And did you spell that for me?
No, really?
Yeah.
H-O-L-O-T-H-U-R-I-A. Holothuria. Zaka, Z-A-C-A-E, Forma, F-O-R-M-A, Iota, I-O-T-A.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you're making me pull things out from... I know that I'm fortunate that I have a good memory, but it's also, I work at it. I call it my memory management.
Well, you do an incredible job. So it looks like you're going to graduate with an undergraduate degree in biology, straight up.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And as you were in your senior year, were you already thinking, I'm going for my master's?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't at all, and I wasn't even going to, I wasn't quite sure what I was doing. I always thought, back when I was a kid, and I was a Devil's Post pilot, I remember seeing a park ranger and going, wouldn't it be great to do that, but I could never. But when I was a senior, somebody said, went into the office, and at this point I needed a job. So there's something called the PACE exam, the Professional and Administrative Career Exam, and that's the exam you took if you wanted to work for the federal government.
Okay.
So because of my work in marine biology, I thought maybe that's where I wanted to go. So I took the PACE exam. I did well. I'm about to graduate, and I'm offered this job, but I'm not offered this job. The job is to be a biologist on a tuna boat and to record if they catch anything else besides tuna, dolphins, and things like that, be an observer. And the guy says, well, you're on the top of the list, and I'm supposed to offer you this job, but the wives of the men on the boat wouldn't like it if there was only one woman on the boat, so I'm going to tell you that you can't have this job. And I said, oh, gosh, that sounded so much fun. He goes, sorry. And he goes, and I went, okay. Now, this was 1977 when I didn't know I couldn't be discriminated against.
Wow.
So that's where I would have gone, right into marine biology, I thought, at the time. And so that didn't happen, but because I was still on this list, when I graduated from college, I got offered a job as a, and I went to the interview in Ventura, California, for the Department of the Navy as a civilian researcher for environmental impact statements. I would get the impact statement, I'd read them over, correct them, whatever it is, and then send them off with evaluations. They showed me my cubicle in the basement without a window. and it would be a profession. It would be a full-time, permanent job with the U.S. government. And I went home to my mom. I was living in the attic at the time at my parents' house. And I said, gosh, Mom, it really doesn't feel right. It's not in the field. It's not doing all this stuff. She goes, well, I should tell you. And this was like GS-7, GS-9, which is pretty good right off the bat.
Mm.
And she says, well, the U.S. Forest Service called the Kings River District for Sierra National Forest and wanted to know if you wanted to be a GS-3 firefighter. I said, yes.
Wow.
I do. So that's how I became a firefighter, because I didn't want to live in a cubicle. And so I became a firefighter, the very first woman on the Kings River District. And
so, Nancy, right there, this is a great place to maybe consider wrapping up part one. Because it's, I want to know all about firefighting in Kings River and you know, what that was all about.
Sure, sounds good.
And if that sounds like a good place, is there anything else you want to add about the ground that you've covered?
It's a lot of fun.
Oh, good.
Oh, I would like to add one thing. My mom's name is Eileen, and my middle name is Eileen. So that's why Eileen is on a lot of my books.
And you're going to spell that for me.
E-I-L-E-E-N.
Thank you.
So I'd like to say, you know, Kent calls me, my husband Kent calls me Nancy Eileen a lot.
Cool.
Because he knows how special that name is to me. And so that's why it's Nancy E, or preferably Nancy Eileen, the Lady Meekum.
Cool.
My mom was everything to me. She made me who I am today. And if somebody had to say what one person influenced your life the most, it would be her. She. It.
That's wonderful. Yeah, no, it just... I was like, wait a minute, you know, two very, very strong, very intelligent parents. One of them made you who you are. That's really neat. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And later on, when I talk about nursing and kindness and what you should need to know, it's her teachings that made the difference.
Okay. I look forward to hearing about
Mom.
That. Gosh. Thank you, Nancy. With that, this will conclude part one. Oral history with Nancy Eileen Malady Meekum. I'll get it right. You trained me.
No, you did. I laughed because you put it in there.
Yeah, well, it should be in there. And you've trained me, so that's good. Today is Tuesday, November 17th, 2020. And Nancy, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Tom. I hope it wasn't just a lot of extraneous stuff.
Of course not. It's really
Alrighty.
Great. All right, thank
I'll
you.
I'll wait to hear from you. Bye.